This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. We're going to survey the important news from all over the world from this past week. I have with me here some of our writing staff, and I'd like to give each of them a chance to give us a sense of what's on their mind for the program today, starting with Robert Morley.
Well, today we'll talk about this upcoming year economically and why it looks like it could be very dangerous and some implications.
Via Skype from an undisclosed location, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'm going to be talking a little bit about what 2015 meant for the land of the rising sun. It was a big year for Japan, so we're just going to go over some of those most significant developments there.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Cologne changes everything. That's the title of our top story from Europe this week, and that sums up just about all the news this week. Cologne changes Germany, but that change is reverberating now around the whole of the EU.
And here in the studio, Brent Noctegal.
Hello, I'm going to be talking about ISIS's recent big gains in North Africa, specifically Libya.
All right, thanks very much. And our top story for the program this week, our front page, has to do with the State of the Union address by President Barack Obama. So we're going to kick it over to Robert for a bit of information about this.
Yeah, it was a very interesting State of the Union address. President Obama covered just a plethora of topics. He talked about criminal justice reform. He talked about fixing our broken immigration system. He talked about economics, the economy, which he said was doing very well. He talked about global warming and the need to shut down federal land usage for oil and gas companies and coal companies. He talked about commitment to rule of law. He talked about several issues that I think probably made people feel like they were in some sort of alternative reality, because the perspective that we got from watching that, or at least that I got from watching it, is that America is better than it's ever been, and things are only getting better as we go forward.
You know, the sort of the soundbite that came out of this is where he's saying, you know, look, let me tell you something. America is the strongest nation in the world. Stephen Fleury brought it out in his Trumpet Daily program. And, you know, this big huzza from the audience. I mean, it was the closest thing to a Donald Trump type moment that President Obama has had in quite a while, but it's just interesting to hear these words coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, I don't think there's too many people that really, if they looked at the world, could think of too many foreign policy achievements of this. If you look at the Middle East, or if you look at Europe with Ukraine, to me it doesn't seem like the world's in a better shape this year than it was last year.
So let's just talk about this a little bit. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this. Stephen Fleury broke it down pretty well on the Trumpet Daily program, but yeah, America spends more on its military than the next eight nations combined. But what are we spending that money on? What does a dollar in a Chinese defense budget or a Russian defense budget get them versus a dollar in an American defense budget?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you could add on to that, how much are nations like China paying Veterans Affairs? How much are they paying for pensions and retirements? If you look at U.S. budget, we're spending more on those budget line items than the next nation is on their entire military. So, I mean, our numbers look pretty good on paper, but as you said, how far do they actually go when it comes to being able to have an effective military?
There's also the questions, or the point that we brought out on previous programs, on just the expense involved in being the premier technological power in the world. How much is involved in research and development and trial and error and building new technologies, whereas China comes along and just steals them and makes it for considerably less, doesn't have to pay for all the R&D costs and so on, just the money goes directly into the weaponry.
Yeah, we didn't see much comment about cyber warfare or confronting some of these nations that are engaged in that directly.
So here we have a president who's basically saying, you know, it's not even close. America is so preponderantly, if that's a word, much greater than any other nation on earth militarily. Let's stop this talk like America is actually in decline. We are actually in the greatest state that we've been. Robert, just tell us more of these sort of contrary to all reality type statements that we had in this State of the Union address.
Sure. Well, he talked a lot about the economy. The economy is stronger than it's ever been. He said we've had this manufacturing surge. He said we have the most durable economy in the world. We've had the longest streak of private sector job growth, and a lot of the unemployment rate has been cut in half. Some of these things are true, but remember, it's coming out of the depths of the depression in 2009 when the economy completely fell apart. President Obama comes to power. So yeah, there has been a rebound for some of these things, but addressing the fact that it's stronger than it's ever been. One thing President Obama didn't even touch on at all is America's debt. Touch on that at all, and for good reason. It's completely embarrassing. It's doubled over his tenure. And if you look at, and we'll talk about this later on today, what analysts are warning out there is that this debt growth is completely unsustainable. And that's the primary driver for this so-called recovery that we see in America today.
So the fundamentals undermine the argument that he's making. He's looking at a set of numbers and a set of criteria to come up with this this conclusion.
Sure, you can make numbers look good depending on where you pick your starting point at. And his starting point happened to be the depth of, you know, the 2009 economic recession. But what I found more interesting was his solutions to and his ideas for making, you know, we're going to make things better and we're going to build the economy. We're going to, you know, we have all these people, he mentioned, in the United States that feel like they aren't doing well. And he said that's because wages haven't grown. And he did bring out a lot of negatives for the economy, but his solutions were just, to me, it was just so shallow. He talked about things like we need to make math classes available to more students. I mean, math classes, really? I mean, he said more students in high school need to have computer science classes. Like everybody, like that's going to solve economic issues. We need to make pre-K available to people. We need to have more teachers. I mean, these are all things that America has already. And they didn't sound like solutions that really would have resonated with many people out there listening. That's probably why we've had the lowest turnout viewership for a State of the Union since 1993. There's 60 million more Americans since 1993 population-wise, and yet we haven't had a lower turnout of people watching it.
Looking at the overall picture of, say, the world, what's happening in the world right now, the number of factors that are demonstrating the decline in American power, the number of different arenas worldwide that demonstrate America pulling back and creating this vacuum that is being filled in the Middle East by Iran and by ISIS, the vacuum that's being filled in Asia by Russia and by China, the vacuum that's being filled in Europe by Germany. We are seeing a revolution in the global order that is being created in America's absence. And here you have an American president who's talking like our stature in the world has never been higher than it is right now. But in capitals all over the world, they would absolutely disagree with that. And they are openly disagreeing with it. And they're revising their foreign policies and they're revising their calculus of how the world works based on an America in decline.
Absolutely. And what we heard in this State of the Union speech is that we are going to see more of what we've seen over the last few years. President Obama said that we cannot afford to be the world's policeman. And I can see America's allies keying off of that statement and saying, okay, that's going to be more of the same, more pulling back. He talked about how we have to build coalitions. Well, fair enough. But that also gives the impression that America is not willing to go and use the power it has on its own. And if you are going to be a world leader, you have to be able to do that.
There was also this tone of he's not going to just kind of sit back and ride out his last year. He's going to be aggressive. He's going to take action.
Yeah, he said that he wants, basically he said that he wants to make sure that the changes that he's built in these last 8 years in office continue on after he's left. This isn't something that he wants to just stop, and he's working to put the infrastructure in place, make sure that he gets as much accomplished as he can this next year to make his legacy as lasting as possible.
You know, we've brought out this point in recent programs, just how much do other world leaders have to factor in the fact that he's in his last year, and if they're going to take advantage of where America is right now, the fact that they can make moves in, you know, that they can be aggressive, that they can conquer territory, that they can take actions that maybe the next president isn't going to countenance. And yet President Obama is going to say, hey, you know, Iran, how aggressive is it going to be over this coming year, knowing that President Obama is absolutely going to do nothing to stop them for fear of jeopardizing this legacy that he's trying to create through this nuclear deal.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid concern. I think Jeremiah talked about this last week a little bit. And there probably will be a tendency of leaders around this world pushing what they can this last year, because like you said, I think President Obama outgoing wants to have a legacy that's viewed very positively from his perspective. And I think that he won't want to risk confrontations the way that an incoming president might.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. We're looking at the most important stories from the, around the world. And I'd like to pivot to Asia. and Jeremiah, you have a story that I think in a sense ties into what we're discussing here with respect to the State of the Union address. Why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Okay, sure. Yeah, this story is really about what 2015 signified for the nation of Japan. But it is intimately connected to what Rob was just discussing there, because much of 2015, as with the previous few years before that, for Japan were really defined by sort of a march toward remilitarization. And much of the reason for that march is basically because the United States is in decline. It's retreating from its role as a global stabilizer. And Japan has relied on the United States for its security for some 70 years now. And so at this point, when they see this retreat and this decline, they're just really hypersensitive to that. And so because of that, Japan is taking all kinds of measures to just realign itself for this changing world order, especially there in Asia. So we published a piece in the Trumpet Weekly. It's by The Diplomat, called 2015, Japan's Year in Review. And listeners may remember that we did a year in review segment in a recent episode discussing how 2015 changed for Russia and China. But there really wasn't that much time there to discuss Japan. So I'm thankful to have the opportunity to discuss this diplomat story and just this general trend, because there really were some significant events that took place there for the land of the rising sun. The highlights of the year included Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's strengthening of ties with India throughout the year. And then he also signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, with the U.S. and 10 other Asia-Pacific economies. In August, he delivered his much-anticipated Abe statement, which was kind of an echo of previous apologies by Japan for its World War II atrocities. In September, Mr. Abe won a really important personal victory when he was reelected as the president of the ruling LPD, or Liberal Democratic Party. He is a really hawkish leader. He's been instrumental in returning Japan to military power status in a lot of ways. So his reelection was fairly big news.
So this story, this diplomat story, it said the overarching, most important thing that happened out of Japan this past year was, drum roll please,
yes. Yeah. The most significant development by far was the passage of legislation to implement Japan's right to collective self-defense. And to understand what that means, you have to have a little bit of history about Japan's constitution after World War II. Unlike any other nation in the world, for the last 70 years, Japan had constitutionally renounced its right to collective self-defense. It was only allowed to defend its own land if it was explicitly attacked by an enemy nation. So it was expressly forbidden to go to the aid of any of its allies. But then in 2014, the Cabinet Legislation Bureau there approved a major reinterpretation of that part of the Constitution. And then this year, or in 2015, in September, that reinterpretation was made official. So legally, it's a very significant change. It means that Japan's self-defense forces could go to the aid of the United States. Say if a U.S. ship was under fire, Japan could assist that ship wherever it was in the world. And imagine if North Korea was aiming a missile at Australia. Well, Japan could shoot that missile down. And these are things that Japan never before would have been legally allowed to do. And then also Japan is now allowed to get involved in what are called gray zone activities if the United Nations is involved. That really opens up a whole array of, you know, really murky, shadowy types of conflicts that Japan could easily be involved in as a result of this change.
So give us a sense of what is happening politically in the world that causes Japan to say, we've got to scrap this constitution that we've been bound by since World War II. We were just talking about America's withdrawal from Asia in particular, but really it's withdrawal from just having a real robust foreign presence in a lot of places. But what's happening, say, within Asia and maybe in addition to America's withdrawal that's provoking Japan?
Sure. Well, yes, what's happening concomitantly alongside that American withdrawal from Asia and just its decline as sort of the stabilizer of global hotspots, simultaneously, China is becoming more and more belligerent. If you look at China's actions in the South China Sea there, 2015 was a year of unprecedented pushing and belligerence and aggression and just China really making some physical actions to back up what it's long just spoken. You know, it's actually taking drastic physical steps to back up its claims to vast swaths of territory there in the resource-rich South China Sea. So Japan sees that, and they see that they can't rely on America anymore. And so they're just taking steps to be able to defend themselves without U.S. backing.
If you could give us a quick idea, maybe of how this would play into the formation of a future Asian alliance. Obviously, China and Japan, very strong antagonistic enemies toward one another for a long time. Is there any chance that we would see some kind of alignment between them? Because this appears to be Japan kind of digging in its heels to try to prevent China from becoming even more dominant in the region.
Yes, we have sometimes talked about the two camps in Asia. And what those two camps are defined by is basically the realist nations, which see that America's ship is sinking, and they're already preparing themselves to be rallied behind China and just dominated by China to a degree. They're preparing themselves to be just unified with China and Russia. But then you've got this second camp of nations that are a little bit less realistic almost. They still cling to a hope, however remote, that they can forge their own block of alliances somehow to stand up to Chinese aggression. And so Japan is there, South Korea is there, the Philippines, for the most part, is there, although they've taken some steps to be able to go either way at this point, I think. So it's at this point, you have these two camps emerging, but from what we know of Bible prophecy, though, they will eventually, all of these Asian nations, I believe, will be, they'll pool their militaries and their power under the Russo-Chinese banner.
Important to keep our eyes on. We've been talking with Jeremiah Jacques. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program, and we're going to turn our attention now to Europe. We have Richard Palmer in the UK. Go ahead and hit us with the biggest story out of Europe this week.
The top article in the Europe section of the Trumpet Weekly is called Cologne Changes Everything. And that's about how Germany is changing. We spoke about that last week, so that's not the main focus of my big story today. Instead, my main focus is on how Cologne is changing Europe as well. European leaders are now accepting, really for the first time, that the EU is facing an existential crisis. That is big news, and that's also new news. You know, to an outsider, it can seem a bit odd to say, well, the EU elites are only just accepting now that they're in a crisis. After all, they've been in crisis basically since 2006. But until now, they've been in denial. Their top EU leaders have been insisting that the euro crisis is over, that everything is fixed. You know, I remember being in a meeting with Herman Van Rompuy, and people were asking about this problem and that problem. And his whole approach was kind of like, no, everything is fine. We've got this under control. But now there's been a dramatic change in tune. This week, EU leaders held an EU reception, or a New Year's reception, sorry, and there are some quite dramatic quotes. So this is what the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said. The EU was tested to its limits in 2015, and I cannot see anything to indicate that this year will be any different. And then the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, he said, last year was the worst in my political career. I cannot remember such a year starting with terror, ending with terror, and with multiple crises from one day to another. Nobody knows what we are facing this year, he said. We're threatened as never before. Now, also this week, George Friedman had a very interesting article over at Geopolitical Futures, which I wasn't quite able to fit in the Trumpet Weekly. The title was Letters from Amsterdam, and he spoke about a talk that he gave to top business executives and diplomats in the Netherlands. And as usual, he spoke about the huge crises that are facing the EU and the fact that he thought that the EU was basically doomed. And he said that usually this analysis is really controversial. In similar talks in the past, an EU commissioner stood up and said his remarks were scandalous. He said that in Poland, in a similar speech, he was loudly condemned by an EU staffer for implying that the EU was failing. And this time he writes, none of that happened in this bastion of European elite. And he said that basically everybody agreed that the EU was failing. He said that some thought that there would be some big changes and that the EU would survive, while others thought it would fail utterly. So just this series of crises that have hit Europe, you know, Charlie Hebdo, Greece, November 13th attack, Cologne, they're really making European leaders wake up to the fact that there's a crisis in a way that they haven't before now.
You know, you mentioned the fact that this is something that a lot of people have noticed. There have been observers who have been talking about this Islamification of Europe, the fact that it was moving in that direction and that demographically it was shifting in a way that was fundamentally changing the nature of Europe. And the fact that the politicians have been so reluctant to admit that all this time, it's just basically delayed the inevitability of this moment. And finally, here it is. We finally have mainstream politicians who are acknowledging this reality that has been building for some years. And it's really the radical nature of some of these acts that have taken place, the list that you mentioned there, that's forced the issue. But it had to come at some point.
Right. But actually, what I thought was really interesting from these comments was actually what they saw as the biggest crisis. It relates to Islam, but it wasn't directly Islam and these migrants. It wasn't directly Greece and the euro. It wasn't even terrorism. There was a top EU diplomat there, and he said the worst nightmare for the European project is an outbreak of populism or political upheaval in Germany. Now it is looking like a real possibility. He said, looking at Germany, especially after Cologne, there is the objective basis for a political explosion if someone lights the fuse. And then the Times noted that Mr. Schulz, he said that he broke with protocol to say that Germany faced existential pressures this year that could in turn destroy the EU. So I thought it was really interesting that they really locked on to this political upheaval, the same way that we have over at the Trumpet, talking about how Islam and the problems caused by Islam, the place to really watch for how Europe responds to that is Germany. And they see that there's the real possibility now for a complete transformation in Germany. They see all the huge political pressures that Germany is under, and they see that this could completely transform Europe, just as we've been saying at the Trumpet for years.
And they're talking about it in terms of a populace that's ready for a fuse to be lit, for someone to come along and kind of capture the moment and really transform what's happening in Germany in particular.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And really, there's not been not been a huge number of times when our analysis would have agreed with the likes of Jean-Claude Juncker or Schultz.
Well, you know, it's interesting just looking at this article that we have quoted in the Trumpet Weekly. This is David Charter and Bruno Waterfield writing in the Times. I actually, as I was reading this article, I forgot that it wasn't our own writing, but there's this statement in here, the anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party has hit new highs in opinion polls, but no right-wing populist leader has yet broken through to challenge for power in the same way as Marine Le Pen in France or Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. But they're talking about the possibility of a German leader having that same level of support, finding that same level of support within Germany.
Right. And also, you know, the Alternative for Deutschland, they're on 11%, which is huge. That's bigger than they've ever been. And that's big news. But what if you had that populist leader, somebody who really articulates these fears, not come from the Alternative for Deutschland, but someone more mainstream, someone like the CSU, the Bavarian Conservative Party that has been much more strong on immigration and on Islam than Angela Merkel's party is. You could see how overnight, you know, they'd have more than 11% support, even right now, even without anything changing, even without another terrorist attack, more crime, etc. You know, they would immediately perhaps even have a majority of support. Like you said, you know, Germany is really crying out for that such person. And if they come from somewhere more mainstream instead of somewhere that has this stigma that is holding AfD back, that would have a huge impact.
Right. It's not hard to see how quickly, say, a Gutenberg type figure would be able to marshal tremendous popular support. The quote in this article, this veteran EU diplomat, unnamed, but there is the objective basis for a political explosion if someone lights the fuse. So it'll be interesting because we've been talking about who this someone is going to be for quite a long time, and the conditions are certainly ripe for that to happen. Well, thank you for this story, Richard. Excellent material for us to keep our eyes on. Before we go to break, I want to pitch it over to our Middle East man, Brent Noctegal. Some big news out of Turkey this week.
Yeah, just quickly, people may have heard that earlier this week there was a pretty big terrorist attack that took place in Istanbul, and that's in Turkey, and it was an Islamic State fighter that initiated that attack. We had 10 people killed in it. And surprisingly, in a way, 9 of those people were German tourists. Now, this bomb went right off in the middle of the central tourist district. One of our employees here, he was over in Turkey earlier this year, and he said, this place, I mean, if you wanted to target tourists, this was the place that you would do it, right in front of one of the largest mosques there in Istanbul. So it's very interesting that, you know, these fighters, they weren't going after Turkey. Turkish soldiers, because of their actions inside of Syria, because Turkey stepped up their fight against the Islamic State, they were targeting specific people.
Very interesting. The relationship between Turkey and Germany is one that we're really watching because they've been aligning more and more with one another in light of this Syrian refugee crisis and the refugees that Germany is hoping to contain within Turkey. So we've seen this kind of alignment between these two, which is something that we've been watching for because of biblical prophecy.
Right. It looks like, you know, there's a lot of discussion in Germany. Were they targeting us? Were they specifically going after Germans because of this relationship that is seeming to come together with the Turks in the fight against the Islamic State? And they put out a joint statement saying that we will stay united, that is Europe and Turkey, in this fight against the Islamic State. So it's really interesting. I think Germany hasn't had a terrorist attack on its own soil yet. They've foiled a couple of plots from the Islamic State. Maybe the Islamic State thought, well, we can attack them somewhere else. And they end up getting 9 of their German citizens killed in Turkey.
It could accelerate this alignment between these two nations. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. The story that Brent just mentioned is in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is an informative report that we produce each week with the most significant stories from around the world. I want to encourage you to subscribe. It's free. You can get it every week in your email inbox if you just go to thetrumpet.com and join over 32,000 other subscribers. Coming up, we're going to hear some more big news out of the Middle East. Brent's going to tell us what's happening in Libya. We have some important news out of China. And Rob has an economic report. Later on in the program, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to start this second segment with a remarkable story out of Libya. For that, we'll turn to Brent.
The story we have in the Trumpet Weekly is entitled ISIS Shifts to Libya After Strikes in Syria. It's from the Washington Free Beacon. And it's quite interesting because it shows that the Islamic State terror group, in a way, is somewhat shifting its focus toward Libya. Hundreds of its members are going traveling over there, have been detected moving over there by both the U.S. And different terrorism centers, one in Libya as well. They've stepped up their bombing campaigns on the border, on the northern coastline of Libya, even targeting oil fields over the past couple of weeks. And partly this is probably because, or this article brings out, that it's been more difficult for these ISIS fighters to get into Syria through the Turkish border. They've clamped down on that, so it's hard for them to fight there. So ISIS leaders are actually urging foreign fighters that want to join the fight to go to Libya, not to go to Iraq or Syria. And there's been, I guess, there's about 10,000 fighters currently fighting for the Islamic State inside Libya. This makes this Libyan arena the second greatest arena for the Islamic State fighters after Iraq and Syria. And it's just very interesting because, in a way, it's something that we have expected more of, an Islamist takeover of this Libyan state.
Right. When did we oust Muammar Gaddafi there?
That was early 2012.
So at that time, when the state was relatively stable, the United States took him out, or a U.S.-led coalition, and suddenly we've got chaos. We've got the Wild West right there in northern Africa, right on the Mediterranean, right in Europe's underbelly. And I remember that story. It was actually April 2011 story where we were talking about how Iran was... our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, drew attention to the fact that this prophecy in Daniel 11 specifically mentions Libya and Ethiopia as being a part of this Iranian camp.
Right. It's quite interesting. When he wrote that article, first of all, that was before the NATO alliance, you know, went in there and with airstrikes to get rid of Gaddafi. The Arab Spring had just started next door.
Nothing was really happening.
Right, but nothing was happening whatsoever. Then within a month of Gerald Flory coming out and saying, no, we're going to see a fundamental transformation of both Libya and Ethiopia into the Iranian camp, into the heavily Islamist camp, then we start to see things taking place. It was a remarkable time to be watching the news. But as time's gone on over the next 3 or 4 years through the Arab Spring, we've seen some states continue to deteriorate. We saw Egypt get embroiled with the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power, but then a strong man standing up there giving some stability, yet there has been no stability in Libya ever since. And Gerald Flory, in that article, talks about the West's bombing campaign inside Libya to get rid of the strong man, Gaddafi, that was holding back some of these Islamists, extremists, and said that in that vacuum, these is going to be filled by terror, basically a terrorist state.
Now, this story, this Washington Free Beacon story in this week's Trumpet Weekly, it brings up the point that as ISIS is stepping into that vacuum in Libya, that there are actually some foreign powers that are looking at this and saying, hey, we've got to do something about this. And the one that they mention specifically is Germany.
Right. And we watch anytime we see Germany get involved militarily against the Islamic State, or against Islamic terrorism, or against Iran's interests. We watch that very carefully. And that you're right. We've got Germany announcing this week that, although it hasn't been approved by Parliament yet, it has been discussed, they're going to send 200 fighters down there to train the Libyan army to fight against the Islamic terrorists. This is the same thing they're doing in northern Iraq, training the Peshmerga there, the Kurdish fighters, against the Islamic State. They're going to do the same thing inside Libya because they see it as a growing threat. Now, we talk about the huge immigration problem that's happening right now because people flooding into Europe from Syria, from Iraq. Well, Libya is much closer than those nations. You can jump in a boat and you can travel up to Italy, and there have been lots of people that have done that so far in the last couple of years. So Europe would be even more scared, I would think, of the potential of terrorist infiltration from Libya if the Islamic State gets a hold there.
Well, this whole relationship between Iran and ISIS is so fascinating to look at, and just to talk about the implications of this relationship, because, you know, as we've mentioned many times, the fact that the Islamic State is out there is it really makes Iran's case for being a moderate nation, and, you know, that they're very legitimate, that they belong among the community of nations, a lot stronger, because, well, they're not creating videos where they're cutting people's heads off, they're not drowning people in cages, that type of thing. And so there's this this legitimization of Iran that takes place because of just how radical and barbaric the Islamic State is. But it really is serving Iran's interests in a lot of ways and increasing their power and stature in a way that wouldn't be happening if the Islamic State weren't doing what it's doing.
Right. We've seen it come onto the world seen as a player that could be looked at for help, an ally even, in the fight against the Islamic State because of its wickedness, as you bring out. And it'll be interesting, really interesting, to see how it plays out in Libya, whether Iran will, I don't know, be part of a coalition of the willing to possibly put down the growing Islamic State threat in North Africa. I could see that happening. But I could also see Iran actually aligning itself in a way with the Islamic State over in Libya if it serves its purpose. Spectators often talk about how Iran and the Al-Qaeda before, they were on, you know, contrary sectarian camps as far as Islam goes. They're not going to be worked together. But what we've seen in the past is that Iran has been willing to forgo or not really care about that religious difference if it serves their purpose. Yeah. So I think we could see that as well. Iran maybe trying to lead in some ways the insurrection of the Islamic State.
Well, I think one thing that we can't forget is that Iran has worked with ISIS in the past. Back when the United States was in Iraq, ISIS served Iran's purposes. They were there's evidence that they were funding them and even creating them before they became this big force. And that was because they were working against the United States and the U.S.'s efforts to build a stable Iraq. So they've done it before. There's precedent there.
This could definitely break a few different ways. But the fact that you've got Germany in the mix does make it extremely interesting.
They're aware. They're watching. They're sending down a corvette, another ship straight down there into the Mediterranean to watch the Libyan coast this coming week as well. So they're hovering. They're trying to contain what's going on, and maybe they'll get increase their involvement in the close future.
We'll keep watching. Thanks, Brent, for that. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. All this instability in the Middle East is having huge implications for Europe, as Brent mentioned. Another very interesting story coming out of Europe. For that, we're going to pitch it back over to Richard in the UK.
Germany wants a greater role for nuclear weapons in its military. A couple of very influential think tanks, including the Federal College for Security Studies, which is the official think tank and policy unit for the German military. They want Germany to do more with nuclear bombs. They want an increase in exercise activities. They want Germany to get its reaction time down so it can get nuclear weapons in the air more quickly. They say that the nuclear deterrence issue is again at center stage. There's another very important think tank. They talk about trying to enhance the integration of nuclear weapons in NATO planning. They want maneuvers more often. They want them to be more realistic. And they talked about basically using or lowering the threshold for using nuclear bombs. So that's a huge and really interesting development from Germany this week that this German foreign policy article we have in the Trumpet Weekly brings out.
This is amazing to see this kind of thinking coming out of Europe in light of President Obama's effort to try to de-escalate nuclear proliferation. And it just reminds me of the point that Stephen Fleury brought out on the Trumpet Daily just a few days ago, that it's like everything opposite of what the Obama administration is trying to do is actually coming to pass.
And actually, this is where things get really interesting, because Germany's nuclear weapons are American. And because of Mr. Obama's program, one of the things he's doing is he's upgrading these weapons that Germany has. He's upgrading them to a new type of variable yield bomb. Mm-hmm. Now, this variable yield bomb can set to be much larger than the Hiroshima bomb or substantially smaller. And this is very much this program is very much associated with the Obama administration. But actually, it's very controversial among people who want nuclear arms reduction, because they fear that having these miniature nuclear bombs, they'll actually be much easier to use because they're less destructive.
Sure.
They're called tactical nukes. They're for using for military objectives. But these are what is happening to the future of Germany's arsenal. And then at the same time, you have these think tanks saying, well, we need to better integrate nuclear weapons into the way we think about our military. You're getting a German military that is a greatly reduced threshold for using nuclear weapons.
One other point about this story that I think is so interesting is that it really is Russia that they're talking about. It's Russia that's provoking this kind of thinking. It's the deployment of nuclear arms against an increasing Russian threat. And that, again, points back to the point that we've made time and time again, that it is a Russian catalyst behind Germany's Europe's unification and their increased militarization.
Yeah, that's what we've been saying for years.
Thank you, Richard. Another story out of Asia this week. We had some quality analysis from the folks over at Stratfor that we've included in this week's Trumpet Weekly. And for this story, we're going to turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, we've got a piece from Stratfor here called China, the Dilemma of International Intervention. This was published on January 6th. And the article discusses the way that China's growth and its advancements have led to some vulnerabilities. But the main focus of this piece is on China's transformation in the last 25 years from an isolated and impoverished country to suddenly being a major actor on the world stage. And during this transformation, China has come to see itself as a really great power and one that deserves a military commensurate with this status. So suddenly China is very concerned about protecting its interests abroad and supplementing its economic influence with military influence. And really the tone for these changes was set back in 2008 when Beijing published its defense white paper. But each subsequent year has brought further refinement to that plan. And then in 2015, China's defense white paper laid out this grand vision, which basically makes clear that the goal is to fully transform the role of the military and expand the military's role to include the protection of Chinese interests abroad. So it's a really dramatic shift away from China's internally focused model that defined China for decades, just this policy of non-interference. But that policy we now see steadily eroding. And Stratfor says that now China is instead gearing up to use its military influence abroad as an active tool of national power. So we've already seen China participate in UN operations and some anti-piracy operations. And Stratfor says this is just the start. Right now we've got Iran calling for China to take on a more active role in resolving security issues in the Middle East. Russia, too, is pushing for China to play a major active role in international disputes like this. And the Stratfor piece, I just want to read one quote from it to conclude. It says, as China adjusts its legal structure to allow overseas actions and restructure its forces to be able to carry out such actions, it will be called upon to use them.
Thank you, Jeremiah. It is nice to have the long view, say, here, let's look at what China is doing today compared to 25 years ago. And you do really get some tremendous perspective when you look at it that way, as opposed to maybe just the most recent headline. But what a transformation has taken place just over the last generation. We appreciate you bringing that to our attention. You're listening to our Week in Review program. It's time now for an economic story that takes us to our money man, Robert Morley.
Yes, well, the Royal Bank of Scotland this week advised clients to brace for what it called a quote-unquote cataclysmic year and a global deflationary crisis. It was warning that it told its clients that major stock markets could fall by a fifth and that they saw oil falling to $16 a barrel. Basically, the bank's credit team was saying that the markets were flashing stress signs that were very, very similar to what happened right before Lehman Brothers failed back in 2008. And then if you recall how that set off this chain reaction that pretty much decimated Wall Street. But they told investors that work with them, they said, sell everything. Sell everything except high-quality bonds. We're in a world that it's more about return of capital, not return on capital. So basically they're saying preserve what you can, save what you can. They said the exit doors are small and it's a crowded hall. So there's some very dramatic moves that could be coming. The implication was people could get trampled.
Can you just give us an idea, tell us about Royal Bank of Scotland. How credible is it to hear this kind of, I mean, this is like apocalyptic type language coming from this bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Royal Bank of Scotland is one of the big three over in the United Kingdom. They're a global investment bank. Their tentacles reach everywhere. They're on the same scale as like a Goldman Sachs or a Bank of America or a Citigroup.
So what are the effects of them making these kinds of statements and basically advising customers to handle their money this way? What are the ripple effects? Even just, you know, you talk about, say, in the United States, the federal chairman says we're going to do this or that, and suddenly, you know, there's this massive effect. Is it similar type situation here?
Well, it could become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes we see these things happen. You get these warnings. People, they react to these warnings, and that causes the very thing to happen that they're warning about. So people start dumping stocks because of this. It creates a selling pressure, pushes markets down, and you can get kind of this snowball effect. So that has happened in the past.
It is interesting. Just think about the how many political pressures, how many geopolitical pressures there are. We keep coming back to this. 2016 is going to be huge. But you add the economic dimension to it, and it just seems the potential for seismic catastrophe to happen geopolitically and globally is magnified.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, oil prices being so low, that is partially reflective of what's going on in the Middle East. This war that's being conducted between Saudi Arabia against Iran and against Russia, you start multiplying those effects in with, for example, Fed tightening. You know, we're entering a tightening cycle in a world that has more debt than it's ever had in the history of the world. Adding debt was how bankers saved us last time, but now we're tightening and credit is getting more dear and nobody knows what is going to happen.
Very important to watch. Thanks for bringing that story to our attention. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to find a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we've talked about in the program today are in there. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at, as many headlines as we can fit into the time from this week that have caught our attention. We're going to start with Richard.
The fallout from the Cologne attacks and the rise of Islamic extremism have really been driving a huge number of the headlines in Europe this week. So Germany was hit by Pegida protests against Muslims, and there have been anti-immigrant riots. 200 were arrested in Leipzig. 4 people were arrested for planning attacks on migrants. So there's a rise in far-right violence. There's also been news now coming out of Sweden that they've been covering up similar incidents to the Cologne attacks. So they've been covering up sexual attacks by migrants on Swedish girls. Most notably, there was an incident where a gang of migrants sexually assaulted teenagers at a music festival. So there's growing outrage across Europe now at this behavior. And then anti-Jewish violence has really been making the headlines this week. There was a teenager claiming allegiance to the Islamic State who attacked a Jewish school teacher with a machete. And this was the third attack on Jews in Marseille in the last few months. And senior Jewish leaders there urged Jews not to wear the skull cap out in public. And then finally, the number of Jews from Western Europe migrating to Israel has reached an all-time high. 10,000 nearly traveled over there in 2015. That's 10% higher than in 2014 and double the number for 2013. And in their report on the subject, the Associated Press wrote that experts say European Jews have not felt this threatened since World War II.
All right, thanks, Richard. Let's turn now to Robert.
The Free Beacon had this piece talking about the rise of terror plots in the United States. It called it unprecedented, and it linked it to the spike of immigration in the United States. It said that there's been 170,000, or there's going to be 170,000 individuals from Muslim countries that entered the United States this upcoming year. There's been 680,000 Muslims that have migrated to the United States in the past 5 years. And now we are seeing, they're saying that there's a spike in terror plots. 1,000 investigations are open in the United States currently. And they said this is unprecedented in U.S. history. And members of Congress and of the Senate have been trying to find out information on this, and they're being blocked by the administration.
All right, let's go over to Jeremiah.
Yeah, well, speaking of terrorism, on a slightly related note, we discussed last week that January 6th detonation in North Korea of what it claimed was a full-fledged hydrogen bomb, just terrorizing the world with that illegal weapons test. The verdict is still out as to whether or not it was a true H-bomb or a less powerful atomic bomb, but either way, it's really heating things up there on the Korean Peninsula. In response to the detonation, South Korea started blasting its anti-government propaganda from huge speakers along the border, which North Korea really hates. So North Korea sent a drone, a military drone, across the border. That terrified South Korea, so South Korea unleashed a volley of about 20 machine gun warning shots really close to the drone, but they intentionally avoided hitting it. But anyway, it just shows that tensions on the 38th parallel there are very high and don't seem to be subsiding.
Thanks for that. Let's go to Brent.
Well, it looks like this weekend at the earliest, the sanctions on Iran are going to be dropped completely. That is some reports out of the United States today saying that. That means that they're going to get that $100 to $150 billion of frozen cash will become able for them to spend. And then also oil from Iran could start flooding an already glutted market.
All right, Robert, you have another one?
Yeah, there's a hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean, and this is very rare, especially in January. This is something that hasn't happened since 1938.
All right, Jeremiah.
One of Vladimir Putin's most high-profile allies says opponents of Putin should be tried as enemies of the people. This statement came on Wednesday of this week, and it's important because it's very similar to language used during the Reign of Terror unleashed by Soviet leader Joseph Stalin there in the 1930s. If anybody doesn't agree with you, silence them, imprison them, liquidate them.
All right, over to Brent.
Today there were 60 Somalian troops that were killed by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa there. And why did they do this? Well, they're trying to stake their claim as a legitimate entity for the Islamist cause. Why do they feel they need to do that? Well, it's because they're competing now with the Islamic State for the young guns, the new Islamists coming up. They've got three groups, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, or Al-Shabaab to fight for, and a lot of them are turning to the Islamic State.
Anything else? Robert.
Railroad traffic in the United States, it's plummeting. Cargo loadings dropped the most in 6 years during 2015, and things are not looking better this year. They go back 30 years worth of data, and they show how these kind of slumps have preceded economic slowdowns and recessions in the past. So not looking good again for that.
All right. Well, thanks for that. That was a lightning round of lightning rounds. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be with you.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Harry Golden, "The only thing that overcomes hard luck is hard work." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.